If you call the Okanagan your home, you almost certainly know a business person. Entrepreneurship is in our blood, as is the incredible sense of community. So this podcast series is really about all of us who love local. It tries to tell the stories of the dreamers, the risk takers, the people who built this place, and who put in new foundations to strengthen it every day. It is said that traveling opens up your horizons and changes your way of life. It is certainly true for my guest of today, Patty Shales Lefkos, who has traveled extensively in Nepal and has come away a really changed person from it, and at the same time has worked tirelessly to make change for the better for the people she has visited in Nepal. Her story is published, but we sat down to talk about her book and her journey to Nepal one day at a time. I will start off by introducing my guest this afternoon, Patty Shales Lefkos, writer, travel writer, traveler, and author now as well, and humanitarian, I think it's safe to say so.
I came to Silver Star, my husband Barry Hodgins and I moved to Silver Star in 2007, full-time, but we have had a house here for 25 years.
Right.
And we used to come alternate weekends from Vancouver, and holidays. We were both in education, so we had lots of good holidays. And so it was lovely when we first moved up here that we already felt part of the community.
You certainly were.
And it's an amazing community in many ways, with friendships, but also with my book and with our nonprofit, both named Nepal One Day at a Time. There's been incredible support here by the community. The Mountain made a substantial donation to the building of the school that we've built. Sue James at Coldstream sells my book and sells art cards that all the funding, all the profits go back to support education in the Gorkha area of Nepal.
Right. It's almost like a community thousands of miles away has come together to support this other community that
yes,
you fell in love
yes,
with.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's like that.
Yeah. So tell me a bit about your journey. I mean, you know, before Silver Star and, you know, obviously, as I said, you were in education, but clearly mountains and travel was always a passion.
Well, I grew up in Toronto.
Right.
But I had the good fortune to go to Switzerland for Ontario grade 13, and that's where I fell in love with the mountains. And also in grade 10, I read Lost Horizon, the story of finding Shangri-La, and that was, for some reason, always appealed to me. There was that magic of that.
So
I went to University of Toronto, and I taught in Toronto for 6 years, but like I said, I saw the light and moved west in 1975 because the mountains were calling. And then I met my husband, Barry, who was a mountain guide before he was a teacher.
All right.
And we ended up just doing a lot of traveling in North America. A lot of canoe trips, ski trips, hiking trips. Oddly enough, when I came home from Switzerland, until we retired, I did not have a passport. And then we started with the international trips.
And then your passport just got stamped on every single page pretty soon.
Then we started with England for the coast-to-coast hike, and then took the giant leap to Tibet to do the Mount Kailash, Kora, and that was my first time at altitude. So we got to 18,600 feet, and it was just fine because we went very slowly. You know, acclimatized well. And after that, we decided we'd go to Nepal. We wanted to go back to Tibet, and we wanted to volunteer, but it's very difficult with the Chinese government, so Nepal was the next best thing. And Barry had always wanted to go on the Annapurna Circuit and the Annapurna Sanctuary, and I was interested in Upper Mustang. And then we said, well, I guess if we're there, we should do Everest Base Camp. So it turned out
a touristy thing.
Yeah, it turned out to be 3 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so you did Everest Base Camp and Annapurna and Upper Mustang. Pretty much length of the country.
Yes, but then in between treks, we went to poker for 3 or 4 days in a hotel with air conditioning, nice food.
Put your feet up.
Get your laundry done, you know, all of that.
That's quite a trip. But when did your thoughts turn from experiencing a trip to putting it down on paper? Because you're a writer and you know you've written.
I never ever thought I'd write a book.
Right.
But I started to, first of all, I was writing for magazines, but I'd gone to Langara for journalism school after I retired, and we're still in Vancouver. I did a year at Langara. And I really thought, you know, I want to get better with my writing. I want to improve and go to the next level. So I started working with UBC, with the program they have for, you put stories in and, you know, and they critique them. And I started writing stories about the trip.
Right.
So.
And so, you know, I often wonder about that because I love photography, for example, and I want to talk about Barry and photographs, but sometimes I feel it gets in the way of me experiencing things because I'm standing back and, you know, thinking about how to compose something.
Sure.
What is it like with writing? You know, do you do it after the fact or?
I take extensive journal notes while I'm there.
Right.
And during my solo trip, which the book is based on, I wanted to do articles about the area, so particularly about Upper Mustan and what it was like, because it had only been opened in 1992.
Right.
And I wanted to see what changes, you know, how the locals felt about the changes, not how we, the tourists and travelers, felt.
Right.
And so my guide, who speaks really good English as well, got me in to see lots of innkeepers and entrepreneurs and teachers and monks that ran ancient monasteries, and I got to speak to them about the changes and also about teaching and what they were doing. But I took extensive notes on all the interviews and with all of everyday journaling. And sometimes I could almost take a sentence out of the journal. I've learned to do that. A friend from San Francisco called Lavinia Spaulding has a book out called Writing Away, and it's about journaling when you're traveling.
Yeah.
And it had some really good advice, and that helped.
Yeah. Well, it certainly did. So tell me a bit about, you know, your, because clearly the book itself focuses on this school that you built. And it was a pretty, you know, series of events in your life which led to you going there and being involved. Talk us through that, if you may.
Well, we came home from the first trip and ended up thinking we'd like to go back and volunteer. But then we, Barry ruptured his Achilles tendon.
Yikes.
And then I thought if I wait, maybe I'll never go because my sister was ill, my best friend had had cancer, she'd recovered well, but there were a lot of things happening in the family and with my friends, and I thought, you know, if I don't go now, that might be my chance. So I decided to go, and after talking to Barry a lot, and but one thing was I knew that I would have the same guide, and we both trusted him very much.
Right.
So I thought, I'm not stepping out of that wild airport in Kathmandu.
And getting accosted by the...
Unless Raj is right there, and he was. So all of the things that I was afraid of, I was able to get past.
And how do you travel to... I mean, I've traveled a bit in Nepal, but never that part of the country. So, you know, once it opened up, were the flights and so on, or was it all, you know, buses and...
To where...
To Mustan, Upper Mustan.
Oh, to Mustan. You fly to Jompsum.
Right.
From Pokhara. Or Kathmandu, either way.
Right.
And then you start walking. And it's... we didn't do really long days. First of all, I didn't want to. Secondly, I wanted to have time to speak to locals and do photographs.
Right,
and,
yep.
I think we did 6 days in. And then we stayed for 2 weeks. There was a huge Buddhist festival, a three-day festival called TG.
Yeah.
And it was on all day, every day. So we got there before, and we stayed after because I wanted to see the difference. There were several thousand tourists came into town. In fact, we couldn't get a room in a lodge. We had a tent for those few days, and that was fine. We had a tent with us. But I just wanted to see what the difference was.
Yes.
And then we had to walk out, of course.
It's fascinating because it brings to mind the question whether, you know, I was going to ask how much of this was planned and how much of this, you know, each individual day, and how much just happened in terms of what struck you and what you wanted to experience.
I had actually interviews with a few of the monastery schools arranged from Canada by email because they had a winter branch in Pokhara or Kathmandu, so you could get in touch with them.
Right.
The others, yes, they were by chance, really, all the other people I met. Yes. And, you know, you sit around in a tea house lodge at night and everybody says, you know, where are you from? Australia, New Zealand, Germany, France, Italy, and you start talking to people and you find out what they're doing and how they feel about things.
Yeah. So what was it about, and I can't remember the name of the specific village that you built the school in. Mm-hmm. What struck you about that? And
about APRIC?
Yeah.
Well, as I, I'd been volunteer teaching in Ramate and Gorkha, mm-hmm. and then we took school supplies around to various villages, and there was one village at the last my guide wanted to surprise me with. And so I went, and it was like being Queen Elizabeth. There were two rows of children all with flowers,
mm-hmm.
welcoming me to the village as the first foreigner ever to go there. It was pretty yeah. overwhelming. And the vice principal spoke a little bit of English, so he led me along the pathway into the schoolyard, and they showed me their school. And it was, at the time, 53 years old, and it was two stories. It was all built by, you know, rock, mud, and timber. And the that area is quite famous for its slate. So all the roof was all slate, which is very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of the beams in the second floor were either cracked or bowed, and the second floor was condemned.
Right.
And they did take me up to show me, but they still had classes on the main floor because that's all they had. Hmm. And the rain came down through the top floor and into the main floor classrooms. And they said, they did have a couple of other dirt floor classrooms beside and kind
yes.
of an L-shaped. And they said, can you help us? Can you help us build a school? So they chose me, I didn't choose them. And
yeah.
And I left feeling like an imposter. Thinking, you know, I did stay for a couple of hours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, the whole thing is from those 2 hours.
Yes.
And I met the parent committee, I met the school advisory committee, and said a few things through interpreters. I met a lot of the kids, and they would stand up and say, hello, miss, and, you know, practice a little bit of English.
Yeah.
Took lots of notes, went away thinking, what will I ever be able to do? What could I possibly do to help?
But you kind of knew already.
I don't know. You know, when I was a teacher, I
yeah.
was in the downtown east side in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very, very used to children from other nationalities because, frankly, 95% of the kids were refugee
right.
and immigrant children,
mm-hmm.
and many lived in poverty. And I learned so much from those children and their families. So really, it's an extension of that.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of me... The kids coming to us in Canada, I was going to them in Nepal. And
yep.
So it was just kind of, oh yeah, there's another place. You know, and I'm not really confident, and I'm not outspoken, but when I can speak for the children, it somehow puts me forward, and I'm easy. And
the
I did a lot
condition.
Of advocacy as a teacher for the inner city kids in Vancouver and across Canada. So this is the next step, kind of.
Yes, except it's, you know, literally the end of the road, not even a road, but...
Well, actually, it is the end. No, there is one teeny village past APRIC. If you
uh-huh.
go across one of those suspension bridges
yeah.
and up the hill, it's called, oh, I can't tell you, tiny, tiny village, tiny school that goes, I think their school goes to grade 3, then the kids come down to APRIC.
Yes, and
yeah.
they travel a few kilometers to come, don't they?
Well, a lot of kids go 2 hours,
yeah.
walking 2 hours each way to school, yeah.
It's just such a great step up, though, you know, once they go to school, right,
mm-hmm.
In those societies.
Well, and when we went to see the first floor done, the Interact Junior Rotary at W.L. Seton
mm-hmm.
had raised money, and they gave me a $1,500. And I spent really almost 3 days in Kathmandu going through, in bookstores, 3 different bookstores, buying books for the school.
Mm-hmm.
They'd never had books, library books, anything. And I, you know, with a primary teaching background, I had a pretty good idea of what I could
right.
take.
Yep.
Dual track books with English one side, Nepali the other.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes all Nepali, sometimes all English, you know, alphabet books, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And it was very exciting when we showed them. They were thrilled. Those kids were so, you know, colorful picture books. And,
yeah, instead of a
yeah,
slate
it was really
and chalk.
Exciting.
Yeah. It's quite something. And, you know, again, just going back to the logistics of putting up a school, I mean, I imagine that you enlisted the village's help and did everything locally.
Oh,
but...
Well, the trekking company
mm-hmm.
that we started with, Ace
yeah.
the Himalaya, their founder and manager Prem Khatri is a Rotarian as well.
Right.
And he, he started a NGO called Sambhav Nepal,
mm-hmm.
and it's and all of the money that comes to Sambhav Nepal goes back to where he came from, which is Ratnate, where I volunteered,
right,
and the Gorkha area.
Yeah.
So he's put that all together. That's so huge. One of the questions when we had the first slideshow here at Silver Star was, can you trust the people you're sending the money to? And I said, yes, because we sent it to one person, not the government.
Absolutely.
And we'd known Prem for, well, 3 months we were there. We weren't with him, but we were with his head guide. And certainly we got to see what was going on. And we met with him several times, so...
Yeah, it's it makes a huge difference in certain societies like that.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, you also mentioned, because, you know, when everyone thinks of Nepal, or when we think of Nepal, we think of the Sherpas and the
mm-hmm.
climbing guides and so on. So tell us a bit about the Gorkhas and who they are and, you know, why the Gorkhas, you know.
Well, as I said, Prem, who runs the NGO and
mm-hmm.
the trekking company, comes from Ratmate village, which
right.
is in Gorkha. And so he wanted to give back to that area, because when he first... When he first left the area, when he was 15, he finished high school. He had seen a bus, but never been on one. He had to walk 8 hours to get a bus, and then he had to take 2 buses to Kathmandu, and he
mm-hmm.
started as a tea boy, a teawala. Then he started as a porter, and then a guide. And most of his work, because the most popular trek is Everest, was in the Solokumbu, the Sherpa area.
Yeah.
And he was amazed at how beautiful the schools were, compared to what he had come from, because of the Hillary Foundation, of course, and the American Himalayan Foundation. There's a lot of money that goes into the Sherpa area. Lots needed, but none was going to Gorkha at all. And
mm-hmm.
so he hires all his guides, all his porters, all his cooks. Everybody that works for the company comes from Gorkha.
Right.
And I asked him once why. He said, because I know all their parents, so they can't come. They can't misbehave.
That's right.
But they're pretty good. They're great.
No, it's amazing to have, you know, feet on the ground and, you know, support that way and
yeah.
And to
well,
know that it's completely
even well-directed. To tell you what it's like, Prem lives in Kathmandu now with
mm-hmm.
his wife and 2 children and his mother, because his mother had to come because she has very bad asthma. She's
right.
on oxygen because she cooked inside for years.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother also lives in Kathmandu. They were just the 2 boys. So they have donated their family property to build a new school in Ratmate village.
Right.
So that's
yeah,
just
that
kind of
speaks for
is.
The kind of
yeah.
Brilliant. That's
mm-hmm.
And you didn't have your photographer along with you on that trip. So
no. Actually,
but he was pretty instrumental in the whole piece, wasn't
yes,
he?
Yes. Barry's photography is what got us our first slideshows
mm-hmm.
And that's made us a lot of money for the education.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was, as I said, a mountain guide and then a teacher and ran an outdoor school in Richmond, B.C.,
right.
an academic outdoor school. And, you know, he's the one that's the really good photographer. So I was pretty nervous and I'm not technology at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a little Coolpix camera, a Nikon Coolpix. It was about $250. And he set it on the highest resolution possible.
Yes.
So that I could get good photos. And also Raj, my guide's pretty good with technology. So I got enough photos for the book. But the best photos are Barry's.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, because the foundation came about as part of, you know, after that trip as well? Or?
Yes, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we came home and, you know, I came home and I thought about it all summer. How am I going to help these people? I've walked away. I can't just not do anything.
Yeah.
And then we'd been at the cottage all summer in Ontario and came home and decided to start the nonprofit. And that was like December 2014. And then the earthquake hit Nepal in April 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we really ramped it up. And, you know, say what you will about Facebook, and Barry certainly hates it, but I found out how everybody was because
yeah.
they had their phones and they had Facebook. So, you know, I got an email from Patty Wilde that morning, big, horrible disaster in Nepal, are your friends all right? And I was able to find out. But those 2 villages, Ratmate and Aprak, were very close to the epicenter.
That's right.
And in Aprak village, every home was destroyed. The old school was destroyed, which is probably just as well. And it was luckily on a Sunday, so no kids were in school.
God.
But four people in that village were killed, and the principal was buried in the rubble for 4 days. I've met him since. He's certainly not the same, but...
Right.
And Raj, my guide, who had lived in his family home, was in Ratmate, and he'd put a lot of money back into it for his parents. Lovely, in that area, one of the nicest two-story homes, gone. He puts a picture on Facebook of him standing by a pile of rubble, and just by bits I can see, I can remember sitting in the courtyard and what it was like. So, yeah.
It was a pretty big earthquake, I think, yeah.
7.8.
And in a hilly area, as you know, it's particularly devastating. So the non-profit started, and then the writing of the book. So clearly it came from a lot of the journals that you'd made. What were you trying to? I mean, obviously the story of the school was one thing, but really you were trying to get people interested in the cause.
It ended up that way.
Yeah.
It started with the way my trip started, which was trying to make a comment on how Upper Mustang and things had changed and what it was like to teach in an off-the-grid school.
Yeah.
Even for an experienced teacher, I thought I knew everything. Apparently I didn't, believe me.
Right.
But, it started that way. And the more I wrote about it, the more I thought, really, it's about, it's about stepping out of your comfort zone and taking a risk. And
yeah.
If you do that, the rewards are amazing and you can be of service as well.
And that stepping out of your comfort zone isn't just, going to the extent of raising money for the school. It's even going there.
Oh, going there, yes, by myself. And, I lived in a tent for 3 weeks, which is not that bad. But when it's 35 degrees and your sleeping bag is a below zero bag for later, it's pretty hot. And one Western toilet in the village,
yes,
which they reserved for me, which was up this high stairway. It was just crazy. And, and it was hard teaching kids. Little kids that don't understand English.
Absolutely. No. Did you experience any of the monsoons? Because it's quite spectacular.
No, we were April.
Right.
Yeah.
Good time.
I came home June the 5th. And plus the end of the trip was in Upper Mustang, which is near on the Tibetan Plateau almost.
Yes.
So it's quite dry up there. One big rainstorm in Kathmandu the day before I came home. Oh. It was just starting.
So it must be pretty high up there. If it's at...
Ratmate is about the same as here.
Right.
And Aprik, they're about the same as 5,000 feet, same as Silver Star. Upper Mustang was... the capital city's about 12,500 feet, but we went over high passes that were about 14,500. But
right.
I was totally fine. Raj just said, just decide you'll be fine and you'll be fine. Thanks, Raj. I mean, I had Dymox and lots of meds with me, but I never needed to take any at all.
I think you've done a few...
it's different every time. Since then, we went on the Manaslu circuit and into the Sum Valley in 2017. And I had to take Dymox for 3 days. Mm. So it's different every time.
Yeah, that's part of you're really on edge.
It depends too. It's how quickly you go up. I don't think we acclimatized well enough near the high pass on that trip.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Upper Mustang, it's much more gradual. And we walk maybe 4-6 hours a day.
Yeah, walking really, walking uphill obviously helps. I'll come to what's next, because I think there are other plans, but tell us a bit about, what do you want people to know about the foundation and the book, and, how can people help?
Oh, certainly people can help by buying the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a win-win situation. You get a travel memoir that's been reviewed very well and 5 stars on Amazon, but... that's a donation. So if you buy directly from me, all $25 goes right into the fund. If you buy from Amazon or other, well, not Sue, the same thing at Coldstream, but if you buy on Amazon, of course, they take a cut, but...
But it's all towards the...
It's a way to, it's also a great escape. I know people that have bought it have told me, right now when you can't travel, it's really nice to be able to spend a few days in another place with somebody else. And that's the kind of book I'm reading right now, too. So.
And so what's next for you?
Well, we should have just been coming home from Nepal because we had a group of 15 Rotarians and some of their children signed up to build 2 homes in Aprik Village.
Okay.
Because even though the earthquake was in 2015, I was back 2 years ago, just before Christmas at this time, and there were maybe six homes rebuilt, six or seven. People don't have the money. They're still living under tarps and tin, corrugated tin and stuff. So the Rotary Club decided that we would do that. So we fundraised for one house and working on fundraising for another, but we also didn't want to just give money. We want to go and be part of it, lend our assistance, kind of forming a long-term relationship with the village. Mm-hmm. I've been there three times now, and last time I just went by myself for 2 or 3 weeks and just, you know, spent time with the children and the families, and I took Nepali lessons, got to know
did you?
Yeah. But it's about, to me, it's about forming a long-term relationship. Not everybody can do that. Some people can physically or financially can give just a little. There's all kinds of ways to be of service in your own town. I mean, I volunteer for Starfish, you know, for the Feeding the Hungry Kids in Vernon, mm-hmm. the backpack program that's started as Rotary. You can do that kind of thing, or... And if you can travel, then you can hopefully soon be able to do that kind of thing.
Well, in the meantime, to your point, we have your book. You know, people have your book and they can travel. And there's so many, you know, somehow books on the mountains speak to people just as the mountains do. So, mm-hmm. And in your case, it's not just the mountains, it's the people that you met. Mm-hmm. What was your nickname in the village? Because there's always a nickname.
Oh, Raj would call me Patty Ma'am, or we have honorary grandchildren that live down in Vernon, and they're the children of one of Barry's former students.
Right.
And they call us Grand Patty and Grand Barry, so Raj being, you know, not quite 30, started calling me Grand Patty too.
Well, it's you know how much in love that is said, so that must mean a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's nice because, as you know, with technology, I can be in touch with those guys all the time.
Yes, that's the wonderful thing about mm-hmm. technology, for mm-hmm. sure. Yeah. So tell me more about Sambhav.
Prem started Sambhav Nepal after he was a porter and a guide, and after he got the trekking company Ace the Himalaya going, mm-hmm. then he decided to give back to Gorkha, to his area. So he started Sambhav. And along the way, he had a sponsor. He was studying business at college, and then I think he has a master's now in business. So, which doesn't surprise me. He's very, very clever. He knows how to put things together.
And he's practical, clever too.
Yes, really. And he's 36 now. It's pretty amazing what he's done. Anyhow, so one of the things you can do with Sambhav, other than support his various projects mm-hmm. that are working with other people in the world, is to sponsor children. So there's various levels. You can sponsor a child at their own village by giving them the money for the family, which helps with their food and their, you know, their school uniforms and supplies and things. Or they recommend certain kids that they see a lot of promise with. And we chose one of those little girls, and her name is Rojina. And they brought her to Kathmandu, and she was, for 5 years, we put her in a boarding school in Kathmandu. Uh-huh. And then now she's in second year physiotherapy college. And it was interesting because I got to meet her the first or second year when I went in 2014.
Yeah.
I went to her school because I thought, I want to know that, first of all, we're getting our money's worth, and secondly, she's happy, and that she's safe.
Yeah.
Now, Prem knows the school. He was very careful at choosing it, of course, but I wanted
to
know.
You wanted to see. Yeah.
Yeah, and I wanted to meet her. So she toured me around the whole school, as did the principal's daughter, who was a mature woman. Mm-hmm. And at the end, it was really cute. Regina said, well, what do you think of my school? Do you like it? She wanted me to like the school.
Yeah.
And so,
it was
lovely.
Which meant she loved it. And
Yes. But I mean, when you think boarding school, okay, the girls' room for her age was one big room about the size of a double garage, and there were maybe 20 bunks double. And that's what the kids had, you know. That was where you kept all your stuff, everything. It was okay. She thought it was great. And they helped with cooking some, mm-hmm. which was really good training. They had a garden on the roof. They had a big compound area where they had ping pong tables, and she did martial arts first thing in the morning. Mm. And she has really become quite an interesting young woman. She's very, very sweet, and she works very, very hard.
Yes. So that's quite the, you know. So there you go, Grandpaddy.
Yes, Grandpaddy. So I did have a little conversation with her, it's awful, but I just said, you know, Regina, because she's absolutely gorgeous, said, you know, marriage is wonderful, but you don't have to get married very young if you don't want to. And she just looked at me as if to say, well, yeah, of course. You know, I mean, she's got a bit, she had a bit of English at that time.
Yes.
But because there are still many arranged marriages, and some of them are fine. It's funny, I always ask the guides and porters after I get to know them, so love marriage or arranged marriage? And they are, they're always so funny. Most of them now are almost a combination. I saw this girl five villages over, and I asked my parents, Blaine, she saw me, and da-da-da. And they're all really happy.
Yeah.
They're fantastic, these kids. So they think that we're nuts, you know.
Maybe they're right. But yeah. Well, it's been a real pleasure having you on here, Paddy. It's, you know, it was very interesting. You know, I haven't interviewed authors before, so that was new. But again, Love Local implies everything that happens around here by amazing local people. And, you know, you are truly amazing. So thank you so much.
And thank you for including me. It's a really nice chance.
Listening to Paddy talk about her experiences and her stories from Nepal made me want to rush out and buy her book immediately. It is something I absolutely intend to do, not only because the stories are fascinating, but also because of the good it does at the same time. Thank you, Paddy, for taking the time to talk to us and tell us about Nepal one day at a time.